The meeting of the Energy Utilities, Technology, and Communications Committee will come to order. Today, we will continue on hearing from the various utilities, today the municipals and the investor-owned utilities, about how they've been complying with the RES and the SIP programs. So first, I would like to call on... Okay, Bill Black and Bob Jagich.
Good. Up to here, things are going well. It's really good, mostly, so far. Wow, we got a lot.
Welcome.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Bill Black. I'm Government Relations Representative for the Minnesota Municipal Utilities Association. And Madam Chair, if it's all right with you, I'll introduce the people here with me, and then I'll give you an overview of our efforts on renewable energy and leave time for the committee to ask questions of the folks here who probably have more informative answers than I would. Then Bob Jagich, our Energy Services Director for MMUA, we'll lead our presentation on conservation and efficiency, and again, leave time for the committee to ask questions of these folks on conservation.
That's fine with me. Thank you.
Let's see. I'll start over to my far right, Joe Sullivan for Missouri River Energy Services, Daryl Tweitbach, Director of or General Manager for Northern Municipal Power Agency, Larry Johnston, Southern Minnesota Municipal Power Agency, Bob Jagich from MMUA, Jim Larson from Minnesota Municipal Power Agency, and Steve Thompson, Central Minnesota Municipal Power Agency.
And Doug Carnival is right behind you.
Ah, not enough seats.
Some of you know Doug.
Representing Heartland.
Okay.
Heartland Consumer Powers District. Thank you. So as to renewable energy, Madam Chair, like the generation and transmission cooperatives who sell power to the retail co-ops, the municipal power agencies sell wholesale power to the state's municipal utilities, who then deliver to their citizen customers at retail. All of the five municipal power agencies and the one consumer powers district serving Minnesota municipal electric utilities will meet or exceed the first renewable energy standard requirement of 7% by 2010. So we're glad to be able to report that to you today. What I have here is just sort of an overview of where those resources come from. And I will just, rather than have each person individually take time to go through them, I'll list them off for you. Some of you have had a chance to look at the Office of Energy Security's report that lists some of this information more or less. And if you have questions about them specifically after I go over them, I'd invite you to ask anyone here any questions you'd have.
Okay.
I'll start with Southern Minnesota Municipal Power Agency, SMPA, based in Rochester, has 18 municipal utility members, and they will have 11% of their energy sales coming from renewable energy by the end of 2010, which is significantly ahead of the RES target of 7%. SMPA owns or has under contract 100 megawatts of wind from wind turbines near Dexter, Minnesota, 2 megawatts from the Olmsted County waste-to-energy burner in Rochester, 8.5 megawatts of wind generation located near Fairmont and Redwood Falls. And under development, they are looking at 1.5 megawatts of landfill gas generation near Mora, Minnesota, and they have project proposals from 9 developers for seabed. CMMPA is Central Minnesota. Power agency has 12 members in the central part of the state, obviously. They currently already have 12.3% of their energy sales coming from renewable energy and are already ahead of the 2010 target of 7%. They own or have under contract 6 megawatts of wind from a wind farm near Garner, Iowa, 6 megawatts from a wind project near Worthington, Minnesota, 2.5 megawatts of wind from 2 turbines near Blue Earth, where ASIMPA is located, or CMMPA is located. 2.5 megawatts of landfill gas generation near Glencoe, Minnesota, which has been a big success story for Glencoe. Heartland, a consumer power district, provides renewable energy to Minnesota utilities. They're based in Madison, South Dakota. They will have 20% of their energy sales coming from renewable generation by the end of 2010. And they are moving towards having 51 megawatts of wind from a wind farm near Wessington Springs, South Dakota. And I believe about 41 megawatts of that will be coming to Minnesota.
Yeah.
MMPA is Minnesota Municipal Power Agency, 11 members based out of Minneapolis. They'll satisfy the renewable energy requirement for 2009 and 2010 by a combination of generation from renewable energy purchases, vegetable oil co-firing generation at the Faribault Energy Park, purchase of renewable energy credits, and wind from turbines planned at each of MMPA's 11-member communities and at the Faribault Energy Park.
Mr. Black, might you have a table of that that you could turn over to us at some point?
I could do that, Madam Chair, sure.
Okay, thank you.
Do that. Further development at MMPA will be, they're looking at 80 megawatts of wind from a project in Iowa, Emmett County, but that's not guaranteed yet. They're working on getting that finalized. Two 44-megawatt projects from a wind farm near Blooming Prairie, Minnesota, and 200 megawatts of wind they are looking at from a wind farm, another wind farm in southern Minnesota that they're beginning to plan for. Missouri River Energy Services has 24 members in Minnesota, based in Sioux Falls, South Dakota. They will have 10% of their energy sales coming from renewable generation by the end of 2010. They under contract are own 3.7 megawatts from wind project in Worthington, 18 megawatts from a wind project in Marshall, Minnesota, which is a seabed project, 20 megawatts from a wind project near Odin, Minnesota, also seabed, I believe, Northern Minnesota Power Agency, 10 members in the northwest part of the state, will have 36% of its energy sales coming from renewable energy by the end of 2010, significantly ahead of the 7% standard. They are proceeding with a lot of wind in North Dakota and bringing it into Minnesota. Some small percentage of wind from Valley City, North Dakota, and Petersburg, North Dakota, also 21 megawatts from Langdon, North Dakota, and 15 megawatts from a wind farm near Ashtabula, North Dakota. So that is just a quick snapshot of, I think, what you were interested in knowing is sort of the renewable sources from the municipal power community. There are challenges, of course, facing the public power community in meeting the standards out ahead of 2010, and they echo what you've heard from the Office of Energy Security and the cooperative power community. They include regulatory obstacles facing transmission siting and wind farm siting, the availability of renewable generation equipment and financing for that equipment, and looking down the road beyond the easily obtained or more easily obtained renewable energy that's come online so far, what we'd call the low-hanging fruit that's been developed so far, the possibility that prices for renewable energy will start to escalate considerably out beyond the 2010-2012 range.
And the reason for that would be?
Well, I would probably like to defer the question, if I may, Madam Chair, to anyone on the panel here who'd like to respond. Probably have a better answer for you if there's anybody who would.
Madam Chair, I'm Larry Johnson with Southern Minnesota Power, members of the committee.
Probably
the biggest thing that we're concerned about in that particular arena is simply the transmission availability to be able to get projects connected. You've heard a lot about transmission over the last couple of years. One of the things that you might find interesting that I will share with you with regard to that, because we have tried to, with the projects that we've currently done, I have tried to tuck them in under pretty much the existing transmission system wherever we can. But interestingly enough, out of our 100-megawatt project that we've started taking trial energy on, maybe the second or third week of December, you've had presentations from MISO over the years, too. So when I throw out locational marginal pricing, or LMP. I'm not going to just get blank stares, and people are going to at least shake their head and act like, yeah, okay, we understand that issue. What we've encountered at nighttime in the past several weeks is absolutely astounding to me. We've had significant negative LMPs. So what that really means, because keep in mind, again, MISO uses locational marginal pricing to try to either incent you to bring your generation on, okay, or it uses negative numbers, which means you pay to deliver your energy. It uses negative numbers to try to clear the transmission system where there's too much congestion. Bottom line is wind tends to be diurnal, a lot of production at night, and there's not a lot of load at night. And so even with the relatively small percentages that we have out there to date, there's a lot of issues with negative LMP starting to crop up. So the solution to that is going to be that we're going to have to find ways to get transmission built. And we can do some creative things with plug-in hybrids maybe to sink some of that night load. But the bottom line is we need to get transmission built, and we need to get transmission built rapidly.
Okay. Anybody else have any comments? Okay.
Oh, Madam Chair.
Senator Anderson.
Just to add to that, I'm glad you brought up the hybrids. That's one of the good news possible solutions. You know, one of the things that will help. I mean, I'm not arguing about the transmission. Absolutely critical. But the only other thing I would mention is that, you know, as we move into the next 5 to 10 years, we can expect carbon regulation, and that's going to help renewables be more competitive. I mean, that's going to affect you in other ways. But I would think that would help to level off the cost increases for renewable energy. Disagree? I don't know. I mean, well it'll make...
Madam Chair, Senator Anderson, I have no doubt that the increased cost of renewables will make them more competitive with non-renewable forms of energy. But it would seem to me like that major result of that would be to encourage people to build more renewables, which is something we're all trying to accomplish. It's not going to necessarily have anyone build wires that those renewables need to connect to. So at the end of the day, I think the concern that we're facing at the moment is we're all doing a pretty darn good job of getting things built, so much so that we may find that we may have to pay to deliver it. And so we really do need to emphasize solutions quickly, and that's for our RES. If we find the federal government passing an RES in the 15 to 20% range, there's projections of needing, well, I shouldn't say needing, there's projections that the Midwest could supply roughly 90,000 megawatts of that. That is huge. That is orders of magnitude way beyond anything people have thought about with transmission in this part of the world.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just, I guess, more of a comment and an invitation. Spent the better part of today trying to brainstorm around these ideas that relate to plug-in hybrids and fully electric plug-in vehicles. And there are a lot of opportunities under our renewable policies as well as our efficiency policies for utilities to interface with that transition to electric vehicles. So I got my little brainstorm list here, as a matter of fact, and would love to have more conversation about, from the utilities perspective, what makes sense, what works, the opportunities that presents. It presents smart grid opportunities. It presents, you know, these peaking issues, these battery storage issues. There's just a lot that's made possible. And, of course, there may be a lot of federal resource to help us along with that.
Okay. Were you finished with your presentation, Mr. Black?
Madam Chair, yes.
Cord cut.
Mr. Jagich.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Bob Jagich. I'm the Director of Energy Services for MMUA. And like Bill said, I'm going to give you a brief overview, and then I will let the members here to be able to answer your questions of specifics for their utility and agencies. All of the five municipal power agencies and the Consumer Power District, along with the independent municipal utilities, are really aggressively pursuing the 1.5 energy savings goal. And they all recognize the demand-side management as the first power supply option that they're looking at. The municipal community has a wide range of experience with the conservation improvement program. from Southern Minnesota Municipal Power Agency and the triad of Rochester, Austin, and Owatonna Public Utilities, with over 15 years of significant investment to utilities where the conservation investment in the past was spent only on their municipal district heating systems. So the new conservation program is a much larger step forward than they're used to having to take. The direct savings, though, that we're seeing are in quite a range from anywhere from 0.8% to 1.5 or greater, depending on the program's maturity. The utilities are also experiencing a greater increase in indirect savings at this time that we don't take credit for. We believe the education efforts and the willingness of consumers to reduce their electric consumption are contributing to many utilities being able to achieve the 1.5% savings, but due to the indirect nature of the consumption, we don't know how sustainable this reduction will be over periods of time. Some of the challenges that the municipal utilities are facing directly is that 74% of our utilities have less than 2,500 customers. This translates to very small utility staffs with no full-time conservation personnel on staff. We're trying to use many unique and different opportunities to help address this issue, ranging from training their technical staff, which includes their line crews and their city workers, to safety personnel to recognize the conservation opportunities that actually occur within their cities. As I stated earlier, some of the more mature programs have also been in existence for such a long period of time that they are, in a way, light years ahead of everybody else, and so some of the easier programs have already been picked away at, and so they're having to go after farther and more difficult projects to meet their goals. We've also started discussion, and we're working with numerous groups to assist and identify projects for the utilities throughout the state. We've started partnering with the State Chamber of Commerce. We've started talking to the Center for Energy and the Environment for assistance with them. And we're also talking with other small contractors throughout the state that as they get programs and opportunities with businesses, that we get contacted so that we can direct them to whatever utility is in that zone or district. We've also been working really closely with the Office of Energy Security, where we're working on evaluation of the deemed savings program and also becoming a one-source stop and shop for issues associated with the municipal utilities, where the Office of Energy Security can make one phone call and direct, and we can then take the questions from them, go off and get the solution where that frees OES up to deal with their other issues, where we're not taking up as much of their time anymore. So, Madam Committee, those are my general comments.
Thank you. I'm impressed with the way people are, the companies are taking this charge and moving forward and finding ways to help us make the RES work and the SIP program work. And I realize you're not under the mandate of the SIP at this point yet, but you're gearing up, and I like the message you're sending that you're going to make it work. So. Appreciate it.
I'm sure.
Are there any comments or questions? Senator Dibble.
Thank you, Madam Chair. We heard the discussion on Tuesday about kind of the customer side of the meter, the customer behavior stuff, and I think we established that our intent is to be able to measure that and count those savings to the extent that the power company, the utilities are involved, and I understand the problem with measuring and also being able to sustain that sort of customer behavior change. And so, I'm really interested in ideas of how to accomplish both of those: A, how to measure; B, how to make sure that that's a savings that perpetuates. So, it's I think another conversation we need to have.
And that's conversations that we've been having over the past couple weeks too. And I did float the idea. I met with the CEOs of the four largest utilities yesterday and floated the idea of a centralized conservation or energy efficiency agency. Then with the exception of one, they weren't too receptive to it. But I suspect the municipals would be more receptive to something like that. And I'm wondering if it wouldn't be easier then to measure and keep track of the improvements and the energy efficiency that occurs. And I wonder if it wouldn't be more effective at an overall conservation plan for the state. Lots of bugs to work out, but Mr. Johnston.
Yeah, Madam Chair and members of the committee. I'm not terribly surprised that that maybe wasn't a horribly well-received concept, perhaps. So let's take a shot at maybe something on the way to that point. One of the things when it relates to the behavioral issues, the numbers that we're talking about here in terms of savings are huge. They're significant numbers. They're strong numbers. They're good numbers. The question over sustainability, there's going to be a lot of things that need to go on in terms of, I think, kind of realigning people's attitudes and having them understand what they can do and what are reasonable options to change people's behavior in many regards. That's not something that's going to happen very quickly and very easily. I have liked very much, although they're struggling with, they have plenty of problems with this issue as well, but California has made the shift. I mean, it's one thing when California did their program in terms of getting people to drop load and curtail. It's one thing to do that when it is a peak issue, okay, not an energy issue or a consumption issue, okay? And it's also easier to do when you're on the verge of having lights go off. That seems to be real effective for folks. And, you know, so you can get people to buy into that, and you can get people to do that wonderfully so, and that's what their numbers showed, in a very short-term sort of a range. Because you can get people to stand up and do almost anything for a good cause for a short period of time. It's the sustainability of that. And as they've now shifted more to looking at what they need to do, thinking about carbon and thinking about energy issues more than capacity issues, they're struggling with that very thing. But there are some real good opportunities there if we could find a way to begin to jointly deliver some behavioral messages on this topic to Minnesotans at large. So we have a common message, a common theme, a common understanding. That's how you finally get to educate people and begin to change ideas. The trick with that is when you begin to accrue savings from that, how do you determine which of those savings Missouri River gets and which of those savings Otter Tail gets and which of those savings Excel gets? That's a tough trick. There's two tough tricks. One is actually measuring it, but I think we can begin to come up with survey work and algorithms that would make some sense perhaps. But a bigger challenge is, in fact, trying to decide how you're going to allocate those savings. So things that I think we can do along that way, I think we'll have to go in that direction, but real challenges in terms of trying to get there.
Senator Dibble.
Thank you. The allocation of savings is, that's a really interesting discussion. Certainly think we should figure out a way to, 5 years down the road when we haven't built a big 100-megawatt baseload plant, to notice that and to measure that and count that as money not spent. There are some other ideas that are driven by technology. I think one of our greatest opportunities, especially around smart grid, some of this technology in the home that relates to the meter and your thermostat and the like, is developing that closer relationship that people have to the power they use. So they're getting information in a real-time basis about the power they're using. It's not dissimilar to our relationship with the garbage that we throw away. We throw it away and never think about it again. It'll go somewhere, It has to be dealt with, or our food that we buy, it just shows up in the grocery store. It comes from somewhere. We have to think about that whole system and what our larger public policy goals. And so I think the opportunities we have with some technology improvements, some rate techniques, et cetera, can get us to some of that customer behavior stuff, send those signals, create that information that people can use so they can think about the decisions they make.
And as a psychologist, I have a lot of interest in personal behavior and, and how it changes and how we sustain it. But, you know, if we could take an example from that, the recycling program and how we changed people's behavior around that and how it has sustained over time and how we actually exceeded our expectations over time, too. So I think it's possible. We just need to start thinking in that direction and rewarding in that direction, I think, too. So.
Madam Chair, there are two utilities that are actually with a grant from OES. Owatonna and Austin Utilities are evaluating a program just like that right now. The municipal utilities had applied for and gotten a grant from OES to do that kind of a reel down their perspective to see what kind of numbers they could gather from that. So we are actually going forward to just sort of, it's a start, but it's a start somewhere.
Okay, great. Anybody else? Senator Anderson?
Madam Chair, just to go back to the RES, then if we're done with that discussion, I just want to also say how I'm just thrilled to hear that without exception, everyone is moving forward successfully. It's really gratifying, and, you know, there's always skeptics out there, even recently, that I've heard that say that some of the portfolio standards around the country are not being met. And so I'm just really proud in Minnesota we're moving forward. So thank you.
We appreciate your effort. And we know there have been challenges. So it's important that you let us know, you know, what those challenges are, too. And we will help where we can. And transmission is one of the areas that we need to address. Anything else? Okay. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Next, we have Dwight Anderson and Tim Gallagher from Minnesota Power.
Now we got to beat the odds thing in Rochester.
Oh, do you?
Yeah. I'm coming back.
Welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Dwight Anderson. I will be covering our renewable energy standard information. My colleague, Tim Gallagher, will be providing information on our SIP program. Do you have a handout? Because I'm turning a page. You've got two on each page, and I've got one. So if I'm turning a page, there might be a reason that we're off. Today's discussion on I should introduce myself. I'm Project Development Manager at Minnesota Power. I work on teeing up projects so that as our resource planning people figure out we have a need, we have a number of options that are available to be able to fill those needs. In today's discussion, I'm going to provide you some results of our efforts to date and also lay out what we're doing to continue that progress to reach our overall 25% target, by emphasis on the second part of the equation. The slide number 3 shows our renewable generation that we have in service to date. You start from the far left. It's our base generation. That's made up of our hydroelectric units, giving us roughly 500,000 megawatt hours a year, and the other is from biomass generation that we had in service before the Renewable Energy Standard came to being. Since that time, we've added wind projects, four of them to be exact, two out in North Dakota, the Oliver One Wind and Oliver Two Wind. Those are each 50 megawatt units located nearby our Square Butte Station where we get lignite power. Next one over is Taconite Ridge Wind. That was installed in 2008. It's a 25 megawatt station that actually are built at our largest customer site in Mountain Iron. And the last one is a seabed project. It's a Wing River out near Wadena, south of Wadena in the Bertha Hewitt area. That's a one unit, 2.5 megawatts. That's giving us roughly 6,000 megawatt hours a year. The two from North Dakota are giving us about 175,000 megawatt hours each. And the Taconite Ridge is 70,000 megawatt hours per year. So you can see with that increase, we're just short of 12% or just short of halfway to meeting our 25 by 25 goal and well in line to meet the near-term needs. Shift gears a little bit and talk about how do we get from 12% to 25%. I'm going to start by talking a little bit about our resource planning. As we add resources, we do it in a very systematic way so that we don't overbuild, we don't underbuild, and we do the right build. Starting off with our customer needs, we don't build to a vacuum. We have to build to their needs to make sure that we provide them with what they need when they need it. We take a look at our existing fleet. What's the makeup of it? What's the characteristics of it and the status of it? And then we have to take a look at the, what are the present goals out there coming through us from statute, as well as what may be coming in the future, so that we make sure we make those right decisions, A, to meet the statute as today, and then also to not build ourselves into a corner in the future with future things that may come our way. To that, then, my job is to kind of tee up a number of resource options, knowing the characteristics of it, what's the cost of it. There's capital, there's O&M, there's fuel cost. Some renewables do have a fuel cost, and I'll cover that a bit later. What's the technical viability? Is it ready for prime time? What are the generation characteristics? Most renewables have a zero. We've just completed a study looking at wood biomass, and that just slightly above zero, about 0.1, what we found there. And then where's the best location for these? Especially when you get to renewables. With a fossil fuel plant, you can haul coal or you can pipe the natural gas quite a long distance. You can optimize to maybe where the transmission is. But on renewables, you need to build it where the resource is. So we have to take that into account. The next slide shows a strategy we came up with here in 2007. We call it our wind, water, wood, is to really kind of give us a focus and give us, I guess, marching orders to myself and other folks in our organization to get ourselves geared up to meet the numbers that we needed to meet. We picked wind, water, wood because of a diversified portfolio. We feel it's critical to maximize all the resources we have to make sure we find the lowest cost. We also took a very aggressive approach to make sure that we identified all of the options. What is the universe out there that we could draw upon? That way, by doing that, we can take a look at that, and as our needs grow, we can make sure we pick the best projects first, again, for the goal for the lowest cost for our customers. Bottom line, all this, find the right type of generation, at the right time, and build it so that we get the right thing for our ratepayers. What this will do for us, besides meeting the renewable generation, is also going to make a dramatic shift in our carbon position. We are a heavy coal-based utility, 90% coal. For years, that's been great for our industrial customers. Coal has been low cost and really kept them healthy. But with coming carbon legislation likely to impact us, we see the need to adjust that. And so we see these projects helping us to reduce that percentage, prepare for the future. Slide 6 kind of starts getting into the resources as we take a look at them. And provided on there are three different resource maps for wind, biomass, and solar. I'd have hydro on there, but I couldn't find a good map to stick in there. But those resource maps really tell a story of why we're doing what we're doing. If you look at the wind, you can see a premium wind really up through the upper Midwest from Texas all the way up through North Dakota. It doesn't really show much in our service territory in northeastern Minnesota, but we're adjacent to it, and I'll tell you later how we have an advantage there to utilize it. Biomass is another good resource for us located in our area. When you get to solar, it's moderate. It's not as strong as the other options. And I guess what's critical there is with the wind and biomass, we actually have, I think there was a study done by the outfit that took a look at the the theoretical capability of meeting needs. And I think for Minnesota, they came up with 1,300% of our needs could be met with wind. So we have a huge universe there available that we can draw upon. Other areas are not as fortunate. You get out to places like California and the southeastern part of the U.S., they don't have good wind. California's got a little bit there, but that's pretty well built out. They do have good solar, so they're taking advantage of that. So it's critical that as you look at these things that you match kind of what you got with what you build to make sure, again, we find low-cost options for our customers. I'll talk a little bit about the individual technologies. First, wind. I've talked already about that. You know, we do reside in a premium area. Our focus areas there are both North Dakota and Minnesota Power Service Territory. Starting with North Dakota, that has excellent wind. It's in the 40% capacity factor range, and that number is critical on a project such as wind and solar as well. That are all capital costs. There's no fuel cost. You're not paying wind gods to buy that wind. And so it's the cost structure of a wind project or solar, it's all in the capital. So you have your carrying cost each year, and it comes down to how many megawatt hours you can divide that by. The higher the capacity factor, which is a measure of how much energy you got versus how much you could have theoretically gotten, just helps that position. So we've got 250 megawatt units out in Dakota right now. Those are in power purchase agreements. And in May of this year, we announced that we made a major initiative to bring more of that wind in. We have a lignite mine mouth plant out in North Dakota. There's a DC line that comes across northern Minnesota to deliver that energy to our service territory. We're partnered with Minn Kota Power Cooperative on that. We own the project together. And what we announced is we're going to buy out Minn Kota's share of the wind, of the DC line. They're going to phase in and take more of the coal, and they're going to build a transmission line to handle what they need on the coal, and we're going to fill it up with wind. So we're going to have a number of wind projects. So the earlier speakers talked about the challenge of transmission. This gives us an advantage to help our ratepayers to make sure we can find that low-cost wind to keep them healthy. In our MP service territory,
Mr. Anderson, is it true that a DC line has less line loss than an AC line?
I'm not an electrical engineer, so I'm going to be very careful here, mechanical. But DC.
I thought you knew everything.
All I know about electricity is they use imaginary numbers, which always scares me a little bit. But the one biggest benefit on DC, besides losses, and that very well could be true, is that when you're transmitting power over long distances, when you do it on AC, it tends to shift. The phase tends to shift. And so it gets to be problematic. Where DC, you put it in on one end, you take it out on the other. That's the good part. You can keep that okay. It's hard to take it out in the middle, though.
Okay.
So for Minnesota Power Service Territory, we have some good sites that are roughly 30% capacity factor compared to that 40%. So they are more expensive. The good part is they don't need much transmission. They're right on the Laurentian Divide, right by our largest customers, and that's, in fact, the first project we built right on the Minntac site, U.S. Steel site. We do have meteorological towers in place at a couple other sites on the range looking for more wind up there, and we'll be assessing that here in the next few years. One thing to keep in mind with wind and it was talked about earlier, it doesn't always blow when you have the load. And in the early deployment where we are today, at least in our neck of the woods, we're okay with that. We can adjust our existing generation around that. It's like a little bit of noise on the system. As that continues to grow, it certainly will become an issue that we have to deal with. And we are presently looking at energy storage technologies, whether that's pump storage, could be batteries. And that battery could be a standalone battery, or as was mentioned earlier, maybe with hybrid cars, plug-in hybrid electric vehicles. Although I got to make sure that they work in cold weather. Sometimes batteries don't work so good up in northern Minnesota. On the water side, that's really our foundation. Our focus there, because we're not going to build any more dams. Dams certainly were kind of the starting point for most utilities. Building more is difficult. All the good sites have typically been built on anyway. But we are focusing at putting additional units at existing sites. We just completed a study at our Fond du Lac facility where we could add roughly 10 megawatts to it. It was technically feasible, but we found it wasn't as competitive as our wind. So we put it on a shelf. Prices tend to rise. Eventually that'll be in the money, and we'll be able to pull that off the shelf and build that project. In the meantime, we are looking at incremental opportunities to be able to upgrade our units, maybe put better runners in and better utilize the water and make more megawatt hours out of the existing water flow. Also looking at some new technologies, there's a project down in Hastings going in. It's an in-stream technology, hydrokinetic generation, and we're taking a look at that. It's quite a fantastic-looking project, although you got to remember that that big, it looks like about 20-foot diameter generator was only 350 kilowatts, so it's not very large scale as we look at the magnitude of the needs we need. On the wood side, wood projects differ from wind, water, and solar in that the fuel is not free. That's a key component as we evaluate those projects. And that so price kind of comes down to supply, and that's a real key piece, especially in these days where there's a lot of increasing demands for that, although unfortunately we had the announcement this morning by Ainsworth that the Cook and Bemidji facilities were permanently closed. We did not serve either one, but again, it does impact the wood demand and our loggers up there, which are a critical piece to future biomass development. So you've got these other things coming in, so that's kind of a negative, but you know, you don't know what the future is going to bring there. On the positive draws, you got a lot of talk about cellulosic ethanol, making liquid fuels, biomass to fuel coming. There's projects looking at replacement of gas and fuel oil at industrial sites with biomass as a thermal replacement for heat, and then our power generation. As we've approached that, we've been very careful that we don't want to be competitors to our good customers in the pulp and paper industry as well as the wood products. We want to be a bottom feeder. We want what they don't want. We feel that it's important that the highest value is made out of that product. They take the roundwood, they make paper out of that, creates a lot more jobs than we do have at a power plant, so we have to be very careful as we develop those. So anyway, on our focus there, we've assessed a new standalone unit similar to our Fond du Lac. It was expensive. It was higher than our wind alternative, so we put that on the shelf. We are working on a number of projects where we can leverage existing facilities, the capital cost there, where they have the wood handling system, so that we can reduce that capital cost and find acceptable projects. We like biomass. It's especially when we site it at a customer site, it makes them healthier, as well as it's dispatchable. So it helps us in that when we get more and more wind to be able to control around that. Another key piece, we are looking at new ways that maybe we can take biomass and convert it and be able to use that in our existing plants without putting a lot of major capital in, maybe displace some coal, assuming there's enough supply there and the price is right. Finally, we're working with forest stakeholders to make sure that we find practices that maximize the resource in a sustainable way from the forest and so that we can meet everybody's needs. On the solar front, solar technology is evolving quickly. It's being deployed in large scales, but it's in regions of the country where they don't have other choices. It's California. There are all these projects going in around California. They've got some wind, but I've seen direct projections there. They can't meet their renewables. It's just wind. They need other sources, so they need to step up and do it. Another piece is they have high rates, so that the margin between solar and their rates is not as big, so that the subsidy is not as large. Along that line, in our region, it is high cost. Compare solar to wind. Solar has twice the capital cost per unit, and it gives you about half the power. So in other words, it's four times the cost of wind in round numbers. So that's what we're facing. And that's why we think it's important that we look at it carefully and understand those numbers so we put our resources in the right place. Because of the development that's occurring, technology is moving forward, and we see a little bit in our region. We do have some motivated retail customers or customers that are located far enough off the grid that they don't want to pay the connection charge. They're making the choice to do that, and we are supporting them through our conservation program. We help them interconnect and certainly try to get them what they need so that they can make it go, but again, not hurt the rest of our ratepayers with those high prices. One thing interesting, from those inquiries we get on solar, we get that from some customers, and once they find out the price, then luckily our same person does conservation. He helps them show them some other more of cost-effective conservation options. So we're monitoring the technology, so hoping that it'll improve so we can make sure it works competitively in our region. And again, as prices go up, there will come a time where it is the right choice, but it's not there today. We are working with the University of Minnesota Duluth. They have an existing photovoltaic system. We're assessing its performance. We put some monitoring in so we can watch it real time. What's a real project look like? What's that dispatch look like? How is it coming into our system? What's the impact of snow? What's all those things? So we understand that. As well as we're hoping to set up some right next to it, some other technologies that we can test with the goal of finding lower cost technologies to make it competitive. So in summary, we're on track to meet our 25% by 2025. Existing policies are successful. We've taken the bull by the horns. We're moving it forward. Some of those new technologies, such as solar and maybe some other technologies, they are being developed in other regions where it is more economic. In our view, over-incentivizing those less efficient renewable generation technologies lead to increased cost and lost opportunity. We could have built more wind. And we got that carbon thing coming next, so wind, that'll certainly help us there. But our bottom line, our goal is to minimize cost when we meet that RES. We got to keep our globally, our customers that compete in the global market, the taconites, the paper mills. We want them to be the ones that keep running and see other plants shut down as the market contracts to stay competitive. So thank you very much.
Thank you. Senator Dahl.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just one clarifying point on one of the last statements you made, Mr. Anderson. The solar, when you said in other regions, were you referring to other regions of the state or other regions of the country?
Other regions of the country. That'd be in the southwest part of the U.S.
Thanks.
Senator Olsen.
Madam Chair, on your wood products, is that – are you growing like hybrid popples, or you're just taking pulp byproducts, or could you address that a little?
Mr. Anderson.
Madam Chair. The low-hanging fruit's gone. We did a project 10 years ago where somebody paid us to take their waste wood from their – they kind of processed it. That waste wood's all used up. What we're aiming at now is the forest residues. After they do the logging, there's a lot of residue left over. Some needs to stay for sustainability. Some can go. So that's the part that we're looking at. Hybrid poplar tends to be quite expensive.
The NRI has undertaken a project to grow fast-growing biomass like poplar. Mm-hmm. And they have had a project going for about 4 years now, I think. And I don't know how successful that's been, but they are trying to come up with faster-growing products.
Can I follow-up question? That's interesting because if you're taking just what's left after the logging operation, those are relatively small pieces of drop-off and stuff, isn't it? Is it hard to get? How do you collect it and all those kinds of things?
Mr. Anderson?
Madam Chair, a lot depends on the type of logging goes on. If they are cutting it and bringing it to the landing, then it's all brought to the landing. It reduces that cost of collection. But there is a fair amount. The other resource out there that I failed to mention was the non-merchantable wood that we can take, and then you get some more tons. But there is a fair amount, and I don't remember the percentage exactly, that's in the canopy per se. Again, the forest products, they only go down to a certain diameter, so it's that smaller diameter stuff that is available.
Senator Rosen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Anderson, in your last slide, or in summary, it says over-incentivizing less efficient renewable generation technology increases cost. Is this a precautionary statement, or do you have examples of areas that have been approached or that we are over-incentivizing?
Mr. Anderson.
Madam Chair. Specifically, I know, I believe it was last year, there was a consideration made to a feed-in tariff, which would come in with fairly high prices. I don't have the numbers with me, but interestingly, I think the wind, it was by resource type, the wind was roughly, I think, 10 to 15 cents a kilowatt hour. We're beating that. We're coming in below that, so we'd certainly hate to see that metric set. They also had one for solar that was 50 to 70 cents a kilowatt hour, which, again, is that multiplier, quite expensive. And so, again, all those things kind of start adding up to, again, end up as being cost to our customer. I think other area was that there was some discussion of a potential carve-out in the RES. We'd rather left it open so that we can maximize our resources. Again, I believe the day is coming when solar and some of these other maybe less developed resources will be in the money, but they're not there yet.
Thank you. Next is Mr. Gallagher.
Madam Chair and committee, I'm going to do a couple of real brief overviews of our programs and how we have been able to.
Just introduce yourself for the record, please.
Again, my name is Tim Gallagher. I'm with Minnesota Power. I am a conservation specialist. My primary focus is on commercial, industrial, and agricultural. However, I do flow over into the residential areas as well.
Okay.
What I plan to do is just go briefly over our programs and leave a bulk of the time for you to ask questions, which is then helps us, and I'm assuming it's going to help you and move the process along a little bit. Our programs are really based on a couple of real basic foundations, and it's practical and flexibility, which really help, especially in changing environments like the economical environment that we have now. The two areas that I'm going to talk about are residential and commercial. Residential produces about 20% of our goal, and the commercial at about 80% of our goal. So that's the core of our conservation programs. The handout that you have in front of you is one of the tools that we have that's just kind of a practical evaluation tool for customers. What we oftentimes find is customers, whether they're commercial or residential, need kind of a starting point, and oftentimes they grasp and start in the wrong areas. So we've put together this pyramid of kind of a decision, or as you see, it's titled the Complexity and Investment. Where we start with customers is providing tools like this chart and like various internet tools that we have, as well as other education opportunities to be able to help customers focus on what it is that they're asking questions about. They know that they want to reduce energy, don't necessarily know how to go about that. So we start with the tools education part of it, and then we move into low-cost, no-cost measures. This is nothing that's new. It's been done for quite a few years, but it does allow the customers, residential customers, to have some successes, which then encourage them to look on to other things. The next area is generally in the area of replacements, and usually that means appliances, lighting, and so forth. We have several programs and some that are being introduced this year, like our refrigerator turn-in program, as well as some of our home monitoring programs that we've gone through and have done in the past and are doing this year. The next area is actually improvements, and that could be structural improvements or HVAC improvements, but that is an area that tends to be a bit more costly, but most customers have to go through that, so we try to prepare them for that. The last area is usually the area that customers, especially residential customers, and even more so now commercial customers, want to start, which is renewables, and we again try to turn the pyramid back around, because not only is this the most costly, but if you don't do the bottom of the pyramid and provide that foundation first, you're generally overbuilding your systems, which means you're overbuilding on cost and potentially reducing the capital that will help you go through and make the steps from the bottom up rather than the other way around. That's basically the residential program, and the commercial program pretty much mirrors that. For about the last 5.5, going on 6 years, have taken the approach of getting away from very large audits that tend to provide a lot of information but not an awful lot of action. In doing that, we've been very successful over those years to progressively make some progress on obtaining our goals. And we do have some concerns about sustainability, especially as we're going forward. It's going to be not only difficult to obtain goal, but it's going to be difficult to obtain goals on top of goals as we go through the various years. There also is a major concern, which I'm sure you've heard a fair amount of, but it's the economic concern. We've gone from when we did our planning in September to having some very optimistic opportunities throughout the year. Then we did a check in about September when we started to get some of the economic news with our customers. And they were still hanging in there with us when they thought that the things were probably going to turn around the end of 2009. But now there seems to be the consensus that their concern is it may be the end of 2010. That being the case, some of them have now indicated in the last checks that we've done with our commercial customers that they're pulling back their resources. They're basically doing when they fail, they're going to be repairing, but they don't have budgets to be doing a lot of capital things that that we had hoped on. But we are making adjustments within that as well. That's basically the overviews of our programs. In addition to that, we do have a couple other areas that help us move our programs around along a little bit. Research and development gives us an opportunity to bring both technologies that are underutilized as well as new technologies into the customers and allow us to help the customers test them out before they have to do it on their own, which would generally not happen. The research then generally, we develop a plan that leads that right into the practical and everyday, and so we try to make sure that we're not looking at research that is necessarily a new technology as much as it is a commercial technology that's ready to go. And then the other is, again, it's a very important part of education. And that's basically the overview of our programs.
Any questions? We lost half of our table here. Yeah. Senator Dahl?
I did have a question, I think.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Gallagher, you said that you had 80% commercial, 20% residential is kind of your marketplace or your territory where you're working. Now, if you go to the commercial side and you take care of that, I understand it's going to be pretty difficult to continue this program and keep meeting these goals if only 20% of your territory is residential. Is there a way, you mentioned the money part of it. Have you been talking with the Office of Energy Security or anyone else as far as teaming up to get money into those, either the commercial side or the residential side, to get some of these projects started that require capital?
Mr. Gallagher.
Madam Chair, yes, we have. I mean, that's part of the process that we go through. I would suspect that we're going to see in the future is even more frequent conversations with the OES. It's something we need to continue to look at.
Okay. Thank you.
Other questions or comments? Thank you, gentlemen.
Thank you.
Our next speaker is Randy Bauer from Alliant Energy. Mr. Bauer.
Good afternoon, Madam Chairman, Chair, members of the committee. My name is Randy Bauer. I am Director of Asset Strategy and Generation Systems Operation for Alliant Energy. Among my responsibilities in that role is the integrated resource planning, which, of course, obviously involves not only conventional resources, but renewable resources as well. I'd like to make a few comments on renewable energy and then save time for questions that the committee may have. First of all, let me thank you for your interest in renewable energy and renewable energy standards and progress of Alliant Energy Interstate Power and Light, or IPL. We presently exceed the standard, and we project that we are on track to meet the Minnesota RES over time. IPL, which also serves a large part of Iowa, is in the process of adding substantial wind generation to our portfolio of owned and operated generating capacity. Our service territory is blessed with some of the most optimal wind sites for wind energy in the upper Midwest and also in the nation, and we do take full advantage of that in our planning. Presently, we're meeting the standard using renewable energy credits, and these credits come from the use of our Midwest Renewable Energy Tracking System, or MRETs, if you're familiar with that. MRETs certificates have all the renewable attributes of owned and operated renewable energy. And in our utility, we allocate those credits on a prorated basis of energy sales across IPL's service territory. In 2008, our RECs, as a percentage of Minnesota sales, were approximately 4%, or well above the 1% requirement through 2009. In 2010, that standard jumps to 7%. We expect that we will continue to meet that RES and project we will do so through 2011. In 2012, that RES again increases, and that increases to a 12% level. We project by that time that we will meet this increased demand either directly through construction of our own owned resources or purchasing wind energy and using RECs to do so. In our service territory, we see that wind energy has by far the largest potential for renewable energy expansion due to its comparatively economic advantage, as well as the plentiful supply that it has. However, the development of renewable energy in the upper Midwest is not without its challenges. Similar to others before me, we believe that the largest challenge facing us is transmission infrastructure required to deliver additional renewable energy. In fact, one of the strategies identified by the Midwest Governors Association that was published in its Energy Security and Climate Stewardship Platform for 2007 was develop regional electric transmission and energy delivery capacity sufficient to accommodate the substantial increases needed in low and zero carbon energy production. And one of the things to that end is the Upper Midwest Transmission Development Initiative that has been kicked off. My company is pleased to be a participant in this initiative, and we are optimistic that by collaborating with our utility colleagues, regulators, and government officials in the upper Midwest that we can find a regional solution to this issue that will allow the development of additional energy resources. My company has been a leader in renewable energy for years. We are working to meet the renewable standards now in place throughout the service territories and anticipate that we will do so. Once again, Madam Chair, thank you for your attention to this issue. And at this point, I'm ready to answer any questions that you or your committee may have.
Thank you, Mr. Bauer. Are there any questions? Thank you.
Thank you.
We appreciate your efforts.
Thank you.
Next, I'm going to call out of order Betsy Engelking and Deb Sundin from Excel. One of these women has a time constraint, so. Welcome.
Good afternoon. Thanks for having us. I'm Betsy Engelking. I'm Director of Resource Planning and Bidding for Xcel Energy. And with me is Deb Sundin, who is the Director of Energy Efficiency Marketing. And I'm going to start out by going over our renewables, and then Deb is going to pick up and talk a little bit about our progress on conservation. I think you have a handout in front of you. That I'm going to try to follow a little bit and just do a sort of a brief update on where we are. You no doubt remember that XL standards are a little bit more aggressive than those that other utilities have at this point. And I've shown them here. Our standards are 15% by 2010, 18% by 2012, 25% by 2016, and 30% by 2020. XL is also unique in a couple of other aspects of our renewable energy requirements. One is that we are the only utility in the state that has a specific carve-out for our renewable sources, and that is that 25% of our retail sales must come from wind energy. So of the 30%, then 5% of our retail sales may come from other sources. The other unique aspect of our RES is that XL Energy is not permitted to sell any renewable energy credits to any other Minnesota utility to fulfill their RPS until after 2020. And so we could generate RECs and perhaps sell them out of state, but we can't sell them to Otter Tail Power, for example, to comply with their RES. Based on those requirements and our analysis of those requirements, right now we are projecting that when we get to 2020, we will have approximately 3,900 megawatts of wind on our system. Currently, we have about almost 1,200 megawatts of wind on our system. And so between now and 2020, you will see an addition of about 1,700 megawatts of wind to meet our RES. Currently, we receive about 11% of our retail sales from renewable energy, and that includes not only wind but also some hydro that we own, some biomass that we have under contract, and several other smaller resources. It does not include the energy that we purchase from Manitoba Hydro, which is not included as an eligible energy technology to meet our renewable energy standards. In 2008, we added 180 megawatts of wind to our system, including the 100-megawatt Grand Meadow Wind Farm, which is the first wind farm that is owned by XL Energy, and 80 megawatts of projects that meet the community-based energy development criteria. We also currently have signed contracts for 42 megawatts of community-based energy that we expect to be online, that's currently under construction, or we expect to be completed by the end of 2009. And at the end of this year, we also proposed 350 megawatts of new XL Energy-owned wind projects that will be developed and transferred to us by Anexco Corporation. 200 megawatts of those wind projects will be in Minnesota, and 150 megawatts will be in North Dakota. Our current plans right now, we have 225 megawatts of community-based projects in negotiation. We expect those to be online in the 2009-2010 timeframe to the extent that these projects can become developed. I think it won't surprise you that with the way that the economy is going, we are seeing more difficulty for some of these developers to bring their projects to market, including lack of available financing and the inability to obtain turbine supplies from suppliers. So we continue to monitor that situation. We also want to make sure that we continue to move to meet our goal. We have a goal of having 500 megawatts of community-based projects online by the end of 2010. And in that vein, just last week we issued a new RFP for seabed projects that would be available by the end of 2010. And we are very encouraged by the current stimulus bills running through the Congress that include, up to a three-year extension of the production tax credit. We are hoping that that will happen because that will also help move these projects forward and to get them online. In addition to that, we are continuing to explore our opportunities to own other wind projects or to partner with others for future development. And on the next slide, slide six, you can actually see what our development plan looks like. We have it has the 3,900 megawatts of wind here that we need to put online. There is an amount that we've already contracted for, and on top of that, we've added our Grand Meadow project, which is now online, the additional seabed that we need to get to our 500-megawatt goal, The owned wind, it says 500 megawatts of owned wind. Now, we did go out for an RFP for 500 megawatts. We came back with 350 megawatts of contracts. There are some other opportunities out there. And we, like everybody else, are waiting to see how things shake out in the capital markets and other things before we go ahead and make those commitments for that owned wind. And then we have the expansion plan. And I think one of the things you'll notice about the expansion plan is that it goes up very smoothly. Rather than going up, you'll notice that our requirements go up in lumps, 15% by 10 and 25% by 16. One of our designs has been to affect this smoother development of our RES in order to keep a sort of a measured development in Minnesota and not to provide these fits and starts that give the wind industry problems. We're hoping to provide a measured amount of development each year, you know, to keep them in steady business, to keep manufacturing plants in steady business. Just to conclude on my discussion of renewable energy, I do want to raise for you one issue that is potentially impacting our renewable energy compliance, and that is the issue of renewable energy credits or renewable energy attributes in our contracts. When we first started developing wind, particularly in the early 1990s, pursuant to the 1994 Prairie Island legislation, contracting for wind and for renewable resources was not as sophisticated as it is today. There was not a contemplation that when you bought wind, you were actually buying both energy and renewable credits or and renewable attributes. And as a result, many of those contracts, fully about 40% of our wind portfolio or our renewables portfolio, I should say, because there's some biomass contracts in there too, or about 4% of our retail sales, have contracts that are silent on who actually owns the renewable energy credits for those contracts. And there have been some legal interpretations, not in Minnesota, but on other contracts, that in the case that contracts are silent on these renewable credits, then the renewable credits are actually owned by the owner of the project and not by the people who are purchasing it. And so as a result, we do have some concern that many of the contracts that we entered into for renewables in the 90s that are silent are not eligible to meet our renewable energy standards. We are currently working, as the gentleman from Alliant mentioned, through the Minnesota Renewable Energy Tracking System, the MRET system, and currently MRETs will not register our renewable credits, or we can't register our renewables contracts that do not, where we do not have clear ownership of our credits. We have petitioned the PUC to make a determination that those credits do belong to us. They were entered into pursuant to specific mandates by the state legislature that we purchase those renewables. And I certainly believe that the legislature intended that we were getting not just the energy from those projects, but also the renewable attributes. At the same time, we've been asked to go back by the commission to go back and talk to our customers about these credits. And at the time that we have talked to them, predictably, they have, for the most part, asked us for additional money per megawatt hour in order to obtain those credits. And so we are waiting for this issue to be resolved one way or another. As I said, right now we have an open docket at the PUC. We're waiting for them to make some determination on it. But if we cannot use those contracts, it will actually increase what we need in order to comply with our RES. And so we are concerned about that issue, and we are seeking resolution for that.
Not sure I understand, Ms. Engelking. Are you saying that you had some contracts that aren't owned by you, but you purchased them from the 90s that are not being allowed for the renewable energy standard?
Madam Chair, what we have right now is we have contracts. Particularly, some of the specific ones are the early Lake Benton wind projects, the St. Paul Cogeneration project, the Fibromin project, which where we entered into contracts pursuant to previous mandates by this legislature that don't specifically grant
ownership of renewable energy credits to Xcel Energy. At the time we signed the contracts, renewable energy credits didn't even really exist as a concept. And so in the contract, we're just buying the energy and capacity from these renewable sources. Now, since some of these rulings happened, our more recent contracts are much more sophisticated, and they explicitly say that we're purchasing not only the energy from these projects but the RECs. But on these early projects, there's a question on whether or not we actually own the RECs. And if we don't own the RECs, we can't actually register those resources as renewable with MRETs and use them for compliance. We even have some cases where we know or suspect that the owners of the projects who are selling the energy for us have sold the RECs separately to other parties. This is an issue that we need to get resolved. When we tell you that 11% of our energy is coming from renewables, that doesn't necessarily mean that we can count all 11% of that to meet our RES currently.
So you're actually buying some of it, but somebody else is getting credit for it? They're reselling the credits elsewhere?
You know, we only know of some very limited cases of that, you know, very small projects that have gone ahead and done that. But in other cases, we have gone back to contractors to clarify REC ownership, and in many cases they've said, well, yes, we'll clarify REC ownership, but in exchange we would like you to pay us additional money for the RECs, or we would like you to extend our contract, or we would like you to let us out of this contract where you're paying a lower cost and pay us something that looks, you know, more like a current cost in order to own those RECs.
Senator Rosen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mrs. Engelking, when the negotiations were going on for the renewable energy standard, was this known at the time? Were your standards are different than the rest of the industry? Were you counting those? Were you automatically assuming that you'd be able to count those contracts for your credits? Was that part of the whole scheme?
Madam Chair, Senator Rosen, we were assuming that we would be counting those contracts. And the specific issue, I mean, we did understand that we had certain contracts that were silent on the RECs. I think the specific issue really came up when we started structuring what the tracking system would look like, the Midwest tracking system would look like, and how they would decide, you know, how you would register your RECs with the system. And that was where they came to the point that they said, you know, we need to see specific contractual ownership of those RECs in order to register those and be able to retire them to meet your renewable energy standard. So it really arose when we started implementing the standard rather than when it was being passed.
Senator Rosen.
Madam Chair, thank you. Sounds just short of extortion, Senator Anderson and I were talking about. That's a very interesting. Is there a dollar figure on how much this is going to cost?
Ms. Engelking.
Madam Chair, Senator Rosen, we don't have a dollar figure on it. As I said, right now, we've actually petitioned the commission to determine that we do own the RECs for those resources. And you know, the commission has come back and asked some additional questions. Again, they asked us to go back and talk to our these contractors to see what it would take to make that happen. We do owe them a status report. I believe that it's going to be filed somewhere around the end of next month or early in March, and then they will go back and consider the issue. Some of the questions that have been raised in that proceeding is whether the commission has the jurisdiction to decide that issue, since it's really included in contracts and maybe belongs more to contract law than to regulatory. But that's our current preference. Our current preference is to have a determination from our commission that says that those RECs do belong to us and can be registered.
Madam Chair, one more question.
Senator Rosa.
I don't know if you can answer this, Mrs. Engelking, but how many megawatts are we talking here that are in question?
Ms. Engelking.
Madam Chair, Senator Rosen, I actually don't have the megawatt figure in front of me, and I can get that to you. I do know that it's roughly 40% of our current renewable portfolio, or about 4% of our Minnesota retail sales, that is subject right now to the silent RECs.
Senator Dipple.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And yeah, I don't know if we're able to solve this or not, because sometimes we actually can't reach in and help out with contracts that are already signed. But it sounds to me like the RECs should belong to you. But I'm wondering, is there a distinction between the renewable energy credits and what we're counting for Xcel under the renewable energy standard bill that we passed? Because I seem to recall, maybe it was just Manitoba, I seem to recall that some of the renewable energy that Xcel was already doing wasn't counting towards the renewable energy standard as we passed it. Some of it is new. It's in addition to.
No, I think we changed that. Mm-hmm. I think that they were held to a higher standard because they were using some of their previous renewable energy. So they had to meet 30% by 2020. Is that correct?
All right.
Yes, Madam Chair, Senator Dibble, that's precisely what happened. The reason that we have a higher standard is because we did have those mandates, and what we wanted at that time was to fold everything into a single bucket, and so we said let's fold those mandates in too.
That makes sense.
But even though we had signed those contracts under the mandates, the way that the RES becomes implemented makes it become an issue.
Would you keep us informed about that?
And certainly
we'd be glad to discuss it with you. Senator Anderson.
Madam Chair, thank you. I'm trying to understand why you have to register the RECs to get credit for this energy, because, and maybe I'm just completely missing something here. So this is actual renewable energy that's being produced, right? You're not just trying to buy credits. And are you trying to bank this? Is that...
No.
Or why you have to register them just to count actual renewable energy?
Yes.
That's the part I didn't understand. I didn't realize that.
Ms. Engelking.
Madam Chair, Senator Anderson, the way that the Minnesota Commission has decided to determine compliance with the renewable energy standard is that all of your renewable energy must be registered with MRETs. And at the end of the year, you are required to retire those credits from your account that meet your compliance. So, for example, if somebody needed to generate 10,000 megawatt hours of renewable energy to meet their standard in a given year, they would have to go into their MRETS account and retire 10,000 RECs to do that. And so it becomes an accounting feature. Mm-hmm. And it's actually a very effective way of making sure that renewable energy isn't counted twice. Mm-hmm. That somebody isn't actually buying energy from a contract and selling the RECs and then allowing the utility to also count that as renewable energy. And so I think all of the utilities actually supported the MRET system as a really good way to develop compliance. This issue just arises because because we do have these old contracts that are silent. And because MRETs will not allow us to register them until it's clear that there is REC ownership. Now, at the same time, most of these owners all haven't tried to register their RECs with MRETs either. So I think they recognize that it's an ongoing issue and that it needs to be worked out at some point.
Okay. Were you finished, or did you want to continue with your report?
I'm completed pending your question.
I have one question about your seabed. You are projecting about 225 megawatts of seabed in 2009-2010. How much of that do you think you will actually be able to capture?
Madam Chair, we actually hope to capture a good deal of that. And one of the reasons why we're optimistic, even though we haven't seen those results to date, is that one of the things that was clogging seabed was the ability of these projects to connect to the transmission and where they actually ended up in the MISO queue. And in the last year, MISO has gone through a reform process to how they interconnect projects to the queue. And as a result, many of these projects that have been trying to obtain seabed contracts with us for probably 2 or 3 years have now been moved to the front of the queue because they are ready, because they have site control, because they meet certain conditions that MISO has now set to move projects up in the queue, so they're not sitting behind imaginary projects or things. And so all of the contracts that we're negotiating with right now either have interconnection agreements in hand or are at the front of the study process and will be able to get interconnection agreements. And for that reason, we do actually have a lot of optimism that we will be able to connect a large number of these projects.
We're also hearing that the seabed projects are having a hard time getting financing. And are you encountering that as a problem with your contracts with them?
Madam Chair, we haven't seen the extent of that problem yet. Currently, the projects that we have under contract do appear to be moving forward and are under construction. We haven't actually finished contracts with some of these other developers, although for a large part, the ones that we are working with are developers that have successfully brought projects online in the past, and in our experience, those are the ones that are most likely to be able to develop them in the future as well.
Okay. Senator Dahl.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I guess on the seabed thing, we only see two examples here today, and I'm just trying to get a scope of how these are working and what are we getting to each of the utilities meeting expectation, or is some doing better than others? I see one, the Minnesota Power one had a 2.5 megawatt facility, and then but Xcel's got 80 up and another 42 online, another 225 proposed. Do we have an idea of where the rest of the utilities are? I'm assuming that most of the obstacles and hurdles are pretty close to the same across the state. Do you have an idea, or does someone else here maybe have an idea on that? How everybody's doing?
That might be. I don't know. Do you have a response? I suspect we need to leave that for another report. But,
Madam Chair, I can only say where we are. But from Xcel's standpoint, we did make a commitment to Governor Pawlenty that we would work to have 500 megawatts of seabed online by the end of 2010, and we have actually solicited aggressively to obtain that. This is actually the fourth RFP that we've issued looking for seabed resources, the one that we issued last week.
Ma'am. Our statute says that they are to consider or to what?
No requirement.
Yeah, there's no requirement.
That's, I guess, maybe what I'm trying to dig at. Maybe it's just that it's the commitment that's made on the part of seeking out seabed projects and seeing them to fruition.
There are problems with the seabed statute, too, lots of problems. So something that we need to look at further. Mm-hmm. Okay. Anything else? We'll look into that, Senator Dahl.
Yeah, I saw that. I saw
Ms. Sundin?
Madam Chair, my name is Deb Sundin, and I'm the Director of Energy Efficiency Marketing at Xcel Energy. And I'm here to talk to you today about our efforts to prepare for the new requirement of 1.5% in 2010. If you look at slide 9 of the presentation that we put forward, the committee here is aware of most of this information, but just to level set us.
Ms. Sundin, pull your microphone a little bit closer. We're having a hard time hearing you.
Is it better now?
Yes.
Thank you. Just to level set the committee, the goal is to get to 1.5% of retail sales. Of that, the utilities are required to file plans at a minimum of 1% of retail sales as kind of the traditional utility programs. And then the legislation also allows other things to be considered to get to that 1.5%. I say that because if you go to our next slide, I'm going to talk about our resource planning efforts, where we're at with that. Our resource plan is currently under advisement at the Public Utilities Commission. We do not have a final decision, but in that resource plan, we submitted two levels of goals for our utility programs. One is 1.1% of sales per year, and one is 1.3% of sales per year. And that was based on an electric potential studies that we had conducted. We have since, the staff is recommending going to the 1.3% level, and in our reply comments to that, we have agreed to strive for that, but we have asked for a ramp up over 3 years to get there. If you go to slide 11, that shows the numbers of what that means in terms of our efforts. Currently, my goal in Minnesota in 2009 for energy efficiency and the demand response that's involved in there is 264 gigawatt hours. In 2010, going to the 1.15%, that jumps that goal up to 358 gigawatt hours, a substantial increase. If we had gone to the 1.5% level, it would have been about a doubling of our efforts. And then when we get to the 1.3%, our current estimate is we will have to achieve about 405 gigawatt hours per year, so a significant increase. What we have been doing to prepare for this, we have to file June 1st of 2009 a triennial plan, which actually lays out our plans to meet these goals in 2010, 11, and 12. In order to do that, back in January of 2008, we kicked off at Xcel Energy about what we're calling 30 growth teams to really look at our DSM efforts and figure out how to expand them to meet these goals. And the intention of these teams, foremost, was to really look outside the box and question all of our policies and procedures and programs that we currently have in place to see if what we're doing needs to be tweaked or changed to actually encourage more participation in our current programs, as well as looking at other program possibilities. The teams were formed around existing program review, program and use gaps, emerging technologies and sector segment efforts. And what is coming out, we're kind of completing our planning efforts in that these teams. There's the primary results we have gotten out of these teams is a list of new development, whether it's new programs or new measures we're going to put in our existing programs in the triennial in June 1st, and where those programs are under development right now. We have looked at providing additional services to our customers, whether they be engineering studies, project management, or planning services to try and get our customers, especially our business customers, to partner with us more. We are looking at additional programs such as appliance recycling and other issues on the residential side. Our residential programs were a little light in the historically, and so we are going to increase our efforts on that side. And we're also looking at trying to market more smartly. A lot of our programs tend to be one size fits all for their customer class, and we market in a kind of a broad brush way. And we are looking at efforts that are more sophisticated on the marketing side, that we actually have different program designs or different offerings for different types of customers to get at their specific barriers in participating in energy efficiency. And then we also are looking at what the rebate levels should be in our programs, and we'll make some changes to those as well as we go into the triennial. I just wanted to talk a few minutes about how aggressive energy efficiency impacts the utility financials, because that is another effort we are working on with the PUC currently and thinking about internally. The goals are aggressive, and they will change our business model as we go forward. And what we are particularly concerned about, obviously, are the lost revenues and margins that are generated in the short term between rate cases from aggressive energy efficiency. And in short, a definition of a loss margin is we collect part of our fixed costs as a utility in the variable rate structure. And if we are selling less kilowatt hours as a result of energy efficiency between rate cases, we are not only losing a collection of the variable costs, but we're losing the contribution to our fixed costs. And we are very concerned about that and looking at that. And then there's also just a lost opportunity for earnings in our capital investment in plant. If we didn't do energy efficiency, we'd be building plants and we'd be earning on that and growing our business. We want to continue to embrace aggressive energy efficiency at Xcel Energy. It is the direction we are headed, but we do need to get the financials in line to make this a really growing business model for us. We are working within the legislation and regulatory frameworks currently to remove these disincentives to energy efficiency and to help provide a positive financial incentive to support the utilities to aggressively pursue energy efficiency. As I said before, the PUC does have an open docket to review this, and we are actively participating. And the federal stimulus package also that is being written in Washington currently also recognizes the need for adequate cost recovery and earnings treatments of the utilities that are involved in energy efficiency. And with that, I am open for questions.
Senator Dipple.
Thank you. Well, looks like we're back onto my favorite subject, rate decoupling. From my understanding from past conversations with Xcel, rate decoupling, as we understand it, is not extremely interesting to them. But this slide seems to tell me something different. So are we talking about something different?
Ms. Sundin.
Madam Chair, Senator Dibble. When we look at decoupling, well, let me go back to my one slide. The one slide shows the erosion of revenues that we're concerned in. Decoupling is, in our belief, one mechanism that can be used to help out with that. But it's not the only mechanism. There are other mechanisms, such as the performance incentive mechanisms, that can actually achieve the same end. Mm-hmm. I wouldn't say we're not interested in decoupling. We have put proposals in front of the commission for gas decoupling that were not received well at that time. The issue on the decoupling side is, let me back up here a little bit. The issue for decoupling is there's a theory on decoupling, and that seems to make a lot of good sense. And then it's getting down to actually developing a mathematical mechanism in which you do decouple the rates. And that's when you get a lot of differing opinions on how that should be done and what should be included and what not should be included. And I believe the commission, when they looked at our gas decoupling proposal, disagreed with what we were proposing. And so we backed away from it at that time. I think we're intrigued with decoupling, and I think it's a topic that we will continue to look at and try and come with some consensus with it. But we're not, right now, we think in the short term, we can handle these disincentives with a performance incentive and cost recovery mechanisms outside of decoupling.
Senator Dipple.
Thank you. So if I recall the legislation, we allow for the continuation of the performance incentives for some period of time and kind of phase them out. It's kind of the old-fashioned performance incentives so that utilities can kind of participate in the overall SIP savings that are being delivered. It's kind of a way to remove some of the disincentive to selling less energy and also recognizing that fixed costs continue even as people are buying less energy, so it's a valid issue and sensitive to it, and that's I think why we put the rate decoupling pilot study in there. What will come of this docket? I'm sorry.
May I just interrupt a minute, yeah, though? Because what happens though is they extend their capacity to sell more energy because they're using less energy, mm-hmm. So they have more of it available to sell to other customers. And there is not the cost of adding on additional baseload at that point.
Well, that's an excellent point, and we need to hang on to that because it's not as if though we don't add population and economic activity. So, well, it's an interesting conversation. What's going to happen as a result of this docket? Does the PUC have the authority to create some new kind of performance incentive? Remove some of these financial disincentives, or will they then make a recommendation back to the legislature to allow for that?
Ms. Sundy.
Madam Chair, Senator Dibble. The process is that the New Generation Energy Act actually requires the PUC to review the current incentives, and it was by the end of 2008. They did open up the docket by the end of 2008. We're currently reviewing different mechanisms, and I believe by the beginning of March, each utility is scheduled to provide through to the PUC our suggestions for what that should look like. The PUC has the authority to approve the new incentive system. So I do not believe it will come back to the legislation by the PUC.
Senator Dibble.
Something I did not know, which was in my bill. I'll have to take a look at that. Let me just say one final thought, if I may. Electric cars might be a way to address some of these issues, to deal with some of the utilities declining revenue, ability to support the fixed costs, the base load, and it deals with a lot of other issues at the same time. So just throw that out there.
Ms. Sundin, do you want to respond to that?
Not particularly.
Okay. Senator Anderson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just kind of want to ask generally about homes versus business and commercial energy efficiency. You touched on a couple of, I think you talked about appliance rebates or appliance recycling, a couple things that relate to homes. But I'm wondering, it's my impression, I guess I've heard the number that about 95% of energy savings come from commercial industrial efforts. I don't know if that's wrong. Maybe you can correct me if it is, or if you know those numbers offhand for Excel. But is part of your ramping up to try to meet these higher standards to try to crack that nut of getting to more homes? And what strategies would you use to get there?
Ms. Sundin.
Madam Chair, Senator Anderson, it is correct that the historical breakdown between energy savings coming from business and residential is about 95.5. We are looking at trying to achieve more energy savings from the residential sector. How we will do it in the short term is provide programs like appliance recycling. We are also entering into, we have approval from the OES to do a 3-year behavioral pilot where it's going to entail 40,000 St. Paul customers of ours, and we're actually going to be giving them different levels of information on their usage. It is going to involve comparison with other customers that look like them, so they know that if they're a larger user or a below average user. We're going to also be providing energy tips that if their bill went up in a certain month, that we can give them tips to try and change their usage behaviors to lower it. That is a 3-year pilot, so that it's a couple of things that we're going to try and test out. One is, will customers change their energy usage behaviors and lower their usage if they have better information? Second piece of that pilot is to see if that will persist over time, or if it's something they'll pay attention to for maybe 6 months and then forget about. So that's why the 3-year pilot. We're also going to be testing what median that the customers will listen to. Do we have to send it in the mail? Can it be online? What types of customers would rather have it online versus in the mail, and that type of test, marketing test as well. We are hoping, because after CFLs, we lose our ability to take credit for CFL savings as the federal standards change over time. There are limited, on the electric side, there are limited opportunities in the residential customer for mass marketing that we can actually achieve savings. And so we are hoping that a replacement, as well as a huge initiative and effort in helping residential customers save energy, will be this behavioral piece over time.
Madam Chair, it
Senator Anderson.
It's one of those things where it seems to me, you know, after all these years, after the first energy crisis, there must be some data out there about what really works to get people's attention and to get them to make those changes or to make those investments. Is there any, do you have any information like that you can use to try to reach people better?
Ms. Sundin.
Madam Chair, Senator Anderson, actually there have been some older pilots that were done on this that showed, and I'm, don't hold me to this, but my recollection is showed anywhere from 5 to 10% decrease in use, but they were not longitudinal studies. I believe the reason there isn't a body of knowledge on this or work on this is because how energy efficiency programs have been set up across the country historically is that the measurement and verification and proof piece of this has really benefited actual equipment change out or at doing something to your home like insulate or weatherization or caulking or purchasing CFLs and replacing. And when you talked about education and behavior changes, how it's been treated, not only in Minnesota but across the country, is that, yes, we understand education is important, but it's been treated as a more of an indirect spend that utilities have been allowed to do in their programs but never been allowed to, because we've never figured out how to measure it, never really allowed to count it as savings.
And this, Madam Chair,
Senator Anderson,
this project will allow you to do that, to count the savings, if there are any.
Ms. Sundin.
Madam Chair, Senator Spending. Anderson, we are hoping that the results of this pilot will help us defend taking credit for these savings as we do these measures with our residential customers.
Any further questions?
Okay. Thank you very much for your presentation.
Thank you.
And do keep us informed about those issues we talked about. The next speakers are Kim Peterson and Lauren Logta.
Madam Chair, for the record, I'm Lauren Lotug of Otter Tail Power, and this is my colleague Kim Peterson, also from Otter Tail Power, and we're the only thing standing between you and your offices this afternoon. So I will certainly be brief because I have convinced Kim to drive 200 miles from Fergus Falls to come and share on conservation today, and you can call me before your committee anytime you'd like. So I passed out a graph looks like this that has a Otter Tail's projections of its requirements and its performance for renewable energy between now and 2020. And what you can see in that graph, since we do business in three states, we have requirements in three states. North Dakota and South Dakota have 10% renewable energy objectives. And when you add these together with Minnesota's 25% RES eventually, you get bars that look like this. So as we move forward, the sum of the white and the shaded parts equal our requirements. And what you see in black is our actual performance. So what's happening today is that we've accelerated wind projects, and we're well ahead of schedule. In fact, I think we're probably in compliance with something like 2012 already. So the reason we've done this is that there's so much risk at the federal level of the loss of the production tax credit, and that's probably why you've seen companies scrambling to get wind projects done, because each year as we go to Congress and try to renew the PTC, there's a threat that it will disappear, and it has disappeared in some years. In the stimulus bill that passed last night in the U.S. House, there is a three-year extension of the PTC included. And this same extension does exist in the Senate version as well. So we're hopeful that we'll get a three-year PTC out of this. But I should point out that the PTC actually accounts for about a third of the total cost of doing wind projects. We've also located our wind facilities primarily in the areas where where we have high wind resources to, mixed with transmission availability. Transmission availability in western Minnesota is almost non-existent. And you've heard constituents perhaps express their frustration of trying to get on the system in western Minnesota. And I think for that reason alone, we've chosen to go to the Dakotas, primarily to North Dakota, and we can get better transmission access in North Dakota. I should point out, too, that the cost for all new resources, whether it's conservation or renewables or coal or natural gas, are going to be higher than resources that we've had in the past. It's not much different than going to the showroom at your automobile dealer and looking at the sticker price versus looking at the cars that are 10 or 12 years old out in the lot. There's a significant difference in the prices that will be required for customers. And I'll just mention a couple of needs that we think we have for renewables. There's a couple of conditions that we're very concerned about as we do renewables. The first one is conditions where we have high wind and low load. And this typically occurs in the fall and in the spring where electric loads are quite low, but we can have very high wind conditions, especially at night. Under those conditions, it becomes we have a lot of energy behind what we call the North Dakota export interface, and we can't get it into the MISO grid. And when that happens, we have transmission constraints, and we can't get energy to where it needs to go. The solution to this is more transmission, and that's why the CapEx utilities have brought to the Public Utility Commission proposals to build large 345 kV lines, one from Brookings to near the Twin Cities and one from Fargo to just down past St. Cloud. And then the other condition that concerns us is when there are high loads, but there's no wind. And we've had some conditions recently like that. Texas had this experience in a very significant way about a year ago where their wind dropped to just about zero, and they had to do rolling brownouts in ERCOT as a result because there wasn't enough gas backup. So what's going to happen is at some point we are going to have to build a lot of gas backup to match up with the significant new additions of wind that we have on the system across the MISO footprint. So with that, I will conclude my comments on renewable energy. Things are going well, and I'll let Kim proceed with discussion on conservation unless you have other questions.
Questions at this time? Thank you.
Okay, thanks.
Ms. Peterson.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. I am Kim Peterson, and I manage the market planning area of Otter Tail Power Company. We are one of the first utilities to file under the Next Generation Act, 1.5%. We filed on June 1st of 2008 for 2009 and 10. Our plan to achieve the goals as they've been laid out. We really appreciate the support of the Minnesota Office of Energy Security and Director Glahn, who approved our plan on November 17th. We are in a ramp-up year in 2009, meaning there is a little bit of time that we have to have our plan in place. And we're pleased to report that our 2010 plan does meet the minimum 1% savings by 0.02%. I would offer also that we're also required to complete our plan to achieve 1.5% by 2010 yet this year. And we intend to comply with that requirement by filing for a part of the legislation that allows utilities to invest in their own infrastructure and make efficiency improvements to meet the additional 0.5%. So we're aggressively pursuing those plans now. What I'm going to tell you a little bit about today is what we did to achieve that 1% and what it kind of took to do that. I would also offer that our integrated resource plan has modeled 1.5%. We were required to model that starting in 2010. That's a very aggressive goal for us. I want to put into context what 1.5% means, because if I didn't work for a utility, I wouldn't know what a megawatt hour was. So 1.5% energy savings goals is the equivalent energy use of about 2,600 homes. In our service territory, it's the entire usage of Canby, Minnesota. Canby is one of our larger communities.
1.5% energy savings is the entire energy usage of, just off the cuff, towns like Hoffman, Murdoch, Herman, Ivanhoe, Kennedy, Rotsey, and St. Hilaire combined. So it's a very large goal. How we approached it after a tremendous amount of thinking was we did substantially increase the rebates and incentives to customers. They are 2 to 3 times higher than they have historically been. We've segmented the markets. We believe that hospitals and government have are likely the best segments for us at this time to focus on, and we'll direct our strategies there in the short term, meaning short term 3 to 5 years. There's some opportunities both with federal and state incentives for them that we're going to piggyback on. And the state has the certification of 1,000 Green Star leads, green gloves. I always want to say green globes there. Green, it is green globes. I always say green gloves. Thank you. The other way around. So we thought we'd piggyback on that as well. We developed 7 new programs. That means our portfolio has 30 programs that we're managing between residential, commercial, and industrial. 11 of those programs are residential and 15 are C&I. What's most unique, I think, about our program is that we're working right now with the Minnesota Office of Energy Security on a statewide announcement about this, as well as the governor's office, where we plan to choose one community that we serve in our area and make that community as energy efficient as possible. It'll be a community-wide effort. We intend to get the help of the high school that's in that area because we believe that students are great energy models. And besides that, they have a lot of energy, and so we need to capture that. We're excited about that project. We're in the final phase of picking it, and it will be announced formally in April. But we think that's got some real potential as a pilot project. And if it works, the theory is that a lot of hands-on education, one-on-one, home energy monitoring, really a focus on energy, if you do spend the time, people will respond. We'll see if it works. We also plan to do that with one college in our service territory. Same kind of criteria. Same kind of focus, but we're excited about that. Our energy efficiency programs do include low-income development and research, and we also finance on our energy bills customers' investments. They can choose financing or rebates. The financing is at 1.9%. We think there's going to be a lot of activity in that given the economic conditions. Certainly there are some risks with financing. We finance that internally. But we'll be looking at shoring those risks up to minimize that. Of particular note is the cost of the programs. The lifetime cost per kilowatt hour in 2010 is nearly 50% greater than our estimated 2008 lifetime cost per kilowatt hour. But recognize that's still around 2 cents a kilowatt hour over a lifetime of a program. The 2009 budget is 56% more than we spent in 2008 and 88% more than we spent in 2007. And the 2010 budget is 81% over what our budgets were in 2008 and 120% over what they are in 2007. So these are significant amounts of dollars that we're investing in energy efficiency. The goals are impressive, but we're on track to work hard towards achieving them. And I'm available if you have any questions.
Okay. Questions?
Madam Chair?
Yes, Senator Rosen.
That's pretty interesting. Perhaps I missed some of the other testimony, but is there any other utility that is singling out a targeted area to do energy efficiency and really concentrate? I think that is exciting because I am sitting here somewhat concerned about the sustainability of all this and how much we can continue on and how expensive, as you just said, this all is, but how important it is, of course. But as utilities, do you guys share your information? Are you collaborating on some of these creative ideas that you're creating here? Because I love that idea. I think it's wonderful. That's a lot of questions there. Are you guys talking together? Let me ask you that.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Senator. I'm very excited about it. To our knowledge, it's the first in the nation to attempt to take an entire community. And that's why I have to, again, thank the
Office of Energy Security because this is a risk. One of our challenges as a small investor-owned utility in Minnesota is we serve very small towns. 453 communities, there are probably 20 of them that have less than 100 people and some with less than 10. And so I'll use the word whining here. For years, we tend to whine about the economic condition of our service territory in these small towns because it's very hard to get to them. Our cost per mile is higher, and so it becomes a challenge. And one day I started to think that I was approaching that wrong. I think it's maybe the best opportunity that the state has because we have these small clusters of very active, very engaged, very family and school-oriented people. And I think working with them and it, really measuring it is going to be the key, too. And I want to touch upon that quickly. But I think you're right. And it is the first that I'm aware of ever. And so these are filed. They're shared information. And this is a pilot. And we plan to measure and verify the savings over 5 years. So there's a fair amount of evaluation plan in the budget to see if it's successful. If it's, we'll know reasonably well after the first year. If the model works, depending on what needs to be tweaked, we'll continue to roll it out. And I think in order of sustainability, it might, in my mind, be one of the ways that you keep this sustainable is I think it could catch on fire from other communities. I'm also on Minnesota's Green Star Cities Initiative. And so I'm working on that project, too, and that's really what their focus is to take community by community and create some energy. And as a utility, and energy being of prime concern to everybody, it just seems logical to me that you try to do it on a community-wide basis, create a competition, create the excitement that goes with it, and I think you got to get the kids involved. And in the screening process, we want to work with a small enough community so we can get our arms around it, but we wanted a community that had a vision for their school to develop a curriculum because we want to see energy as part of the curriculum in that high school. And you could start small, but when you get in the 9, 10, 11, and 12, those children can, you know, they can do demand-side management, and they can understand energy efficiency. And there's nothing wrong with teaching them a little bit about generation because this is such a focus for our country. And so we're going to work with the school on developing a very simplified curriculum. We'll call it mini workshops to start with and see how it goes. But I think that's maybe that's part of the secret.
Madam Chair, that is just fun. That is just plain fun. And I would like to challenge all the other utilities to somehow think in that scope of, you know, if they serve a larger area, perhaps they can single out a certain area. And just focus on that and develop that creative energy that you are obviously doing. My question to you is there any money in the Office of Energy Security for something like that? Any grant money that that can help you out? I'm just wondering.
Madam Chair and members of the committee.
Ms. Peterson.
Thank you. They have money, but we haven't asked for it. They have an R&D fund that is available, and it's a significant amount of money. And we have given thought about the best approach to that funding source. I think it would be a good use of that money, but as of yet, we haven't asked. I'm sure they'd be open to that discussion in the criteria that they've developed for grant application.
Well, Madam Chair, and that's my question, Ms. Anderson, is or perhaps somebody from the office can say what is the criteria for that R&D, for that grant money, would that apply?
Director Glahn or Ms. Streff?
I have to go up there.
Yeah, please.
Walk it up so she can sit down.
I remember all of the criteria. Hi, I'm Janet Streff. I'm director of the State Energy Office, and we have oversight of the conservation program. The criteria are fairly broad, and they are discussed before each grant cycle. We're just going into the second grant cycle now. The RFP is being finished right now, so it should be coming out. But we try and address various areas that we know work needs to be done. This last year we did focus a lot on what kinds of work can be done for changing people's behavior, and that's why we have so many projects on that. Certainly energy education is one area that we think is important and would most likely provide money for as a put a criteria in for. I'm not sure that it is in that criteria this year specifically. I know that we've had a lot of interest and on different pilot projects to do different energy efficiency things, and so there is a fair amount of the money that we're hoping will be spent for that. I can send you the RFP when it comes out.
Senator Rosen.
Madam Chair, thank you. Could you please tell me how much is in that fund and what kind of projects, more specific, what the funds have been used for?
We've had just one round, Madam Chair and Senator Rosen, we've had just one round. The assessment is $3.6 million annually, and last year the legislature saw fit for us to send up to $500,000 of that money annually to the Center for Sustainable Building Research to do work on making buildings reach a net zero energy use, and that includes training and education for architects and engineers as well. So there's education, I guess, in that part. I guess I would ask if I could send you the list. There were several projects, 10 or 20, I think, that actually came out of those. But I'd be happy to send you the list.
Oh, appreciate that. Thank you.
Okay. Senator Dibble.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I concur with Senator Rosen. It's exciting to think, especially this, engaging the community activity. I'm glad you're part of the Green Stars. I was gonna ask about that. And I was also gonna answer another one of Senator Rosen's questions, do we share this information? Office of Energy Security is also directed by the legislation to serve as the clearinghouse and the purveyor of information and the like. We actually allow them to assess some money to do that as well. So they are serving as a clearinghouse and also are able to assess some. I was going to mention the money we're talking about isn't magic money that they've come up with out of the general fund. All the kind utilities here actually pay that into that fund from the ratepayers. Those are dollars that we've assessed specifically in the legislation, $800,000 for the technical assistance and the clearinghouse stuff, the 3.6 to do the R&D, the on-the-ground research for best practices, the $500,000 that goes to develop kind of the great building codes, the Building 2030 stuff that we do over at the University of Minnesota. So there's a lot. You also asked about the sustainability of, year over year, how do we continue to do these sorts of savings. And it is a concern, but also we need to remember that the legislation allows for all kinds of things to happen from generation to transmission to the consumer side. So it's about how we build buildings. There's a lot of drafty houses out there, many houses that could use better energy practices. We got a long ways to go, I think, till we run out of savings. Working with industry to create more energy efficient appliances, getting those appliances deployed. So I think there's a long ways to go before we run out of the ability to save energy. California has achieved no growth per capita in energy use, despite growing population and growing consumer goods and the like. So they've figured something out. They add population, and people in that population are adding the flat screen TVs and all of that stuff. But still, there's a flat line if you look at the per capita energy use. Energy use overall, of course, is going up because population is going up, but the per capita use has remained stable for about 10 years now.
Madam Chair.
Yes. Senator Rosen.
Thank you. And Senator Dibble, I appreciate that. And I'm not suggesting that we're going to, you know, change anything. But I do know that this committee and the legislature is sensitive enough to know that. But we do have off-ramps built into the legislation. So.
Yes, it all has to – everyone has to save money. Can't be spending a bunch of money everyone's losing money.
I just want to make
sure that's a requirement in the statute that's repeated over and over again. The commissioner or the deputy can't approve plans that don't make economic sense. The utilities commission can't approve plans that don't make economic sense.
And I can't help but think how lucky the winner of the winning city is going to be able to go through this transformation.
Chair and members of the committee, I think that's correct. We have invited the governor to make a proclamation. We happen to be also celebrating our 100th anniversary as a company in Minnesota. So it's a very exciting year. And in conjunction with that, we're seeing this community challenge as a pay it forward project, if you will. We're focusing a lot less on the fact that we're 100 years old as we want to be around serving customers for another 100 years. And conserving energy is one way of paying it forward. And so that's how we're labeling this project, and I think that will get the attention as well because people understand that concept. And if I could offer one last comment, and it ties in more with the resource planning discussion, but it is a research issue, and I think one that shows great promise. Because we serve Minnesota, North Dakota, and South Dakota, we have a tremendous amount of heating load. We have been researching, installing thermal storage systems for a number of years. In the last 2 years, we've seen 17% growth in that. How that relates to wind is this. If we can connect the central storage systems to the wind delivery, we'll store those systems up with wind energy, theoretically, when the wind is blowing, to maximize the North Dakota energy that is available, minimizing the North Dakota energy export issue. I think that shows great promise. We're working with a couple of the vendors right now on that. It's similar to the PHEV technology, except it's heating homes and water heating. And you'll be hearing much more about that in the future as well.
Thank you for your presentation. And that does bring us to the end of our meeting tonight, and we've been very successful at ending right on time. I have my committee administrator's done a great job with his first few meetings. Our next meeting will be on Tuesday, February 3rd, and this will be a continuation of the discussion on Senator Sharon's Senate File 13. Meeting is adjourned.